In the meantime, minus left. In the meantime, minus left. We were busy putting barbs on a large iron gate.
Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus,
programs, and welcome to another episode of Quarks and Recreation. I'm your co-host, Doug.
I'm your other co-host, Brandon.
And this week, we are covering the New Horizons mission to Pluto. We just had the flyby on Tuesday, July 14th, and we're recording this the following Saturday, so this just happened. So we're going to have some brand new scientific information about Pluto, but there's still a whole lot more to come as the spacecraft beams back information to Earth. Is there a place you kind of wanted to start with talking about Pluto? Questions you have?
Yeah, first of all, just to make this clear, we're not talking about Mickey Mouse Pluto.
No. Actually, interesting fact about Mickey Mouse Pluto. So Mickey Mouse, the Disney Pluto character, was created in 1930, the same year that Pluto, the dwarf planet, was discovered. And that's, in fact, why the dog has that name. It was a big news event at the time, so it was cool for Walt Disney to name the dog that. The other weird thing is it turns out that the dog and the dwarf planet are both roughly the same color. They're both kind of this reddish-brownish, orangey color. So Disney actually got one right there as a long time, as a guess, 75 or 85 years in the future. So
I guess one thing is, like, the saddest part of anything ever that ever happened is that Pluto's not a planet anymore.
People lost their minds over that. Yeah, in 2000 and I think 6 or 5, Pluto was demoted from one of the 9 planets to now one of the 8. There's now the 8 planets, and Pluto's a dwarf planet. Do you know why that happened?
No, I mean, I don't see how, like, a bunch of politicians can just sit in a room and vote on that. I mean,
well, thankfully, it's not elected politicians. It's a scientific body that made that decision. But they made the decision on, it was kind of an interesting story. So, in the mid-2000s, telescopes were getting better and better, and we were looking in the outer reaches of the solar system in kind of Pluto's neighborhood, and an astronomer by the name of Mike Brown discovered an object that was farther away than, in fact, it's much farther away than Pluto, and it's roughly the same size. We now know this object is actually a little bit smaller than Pluto, although it's much more massive. It's a lot denser. Like, it's a whatever it's made of is
harder.
It's harder, and there's more of it in a smaller space. But anyway, this object became known as Eris eventually. That was the name it was given, E-R-I-S. And so now there was a question, like, is this a 10th planet? And they said, well, maybe, but if this thing is going to be a planet, there's actually lots of interesting weird objects that populate the outer solar system. There's one called Quawar. There's one called Makemake. And so the problem starts going, like, well, okay, if Pluto's still going to be a planet, then now we're up to like 14 or 15. And where does it stop? There might be, you know, tons and tons of these things. So it gets unmanageable. So what they decided to do was reclassify Pluto as a dwarf planet. So they said to be a full-fledged planet, you have to have two things. One, you got to be round. You have to have enough gravity to pull yourself into a sphere. And if you look at, like, small things like asteroids and some small moons, they're kind of, like, potato-shaped or weird-looking. They don't have enough mass for their gravity to, like, crush them down into a sphere. So, one, spherical. And Pluto has that. Pluto is certainly round. It's pretty big, actually. It's a little bit smaller than our moon. But it doesn't have the second criteria, which is, to be a planet, you have to sweep your orbit clear of debris. So that's where Pluto has a problem. The neighborhood where Pluto orbits in is relatively busy. It's called the Kuiper Belt. And it's this area that extends beyond the orbit of Neptune, and it's full of mostly things like comets and balls of ice that are left over from the formation of the solar system. They never fell down into the sun. They never got had enough gravity to pull together into a whole new planet of any major size. So it's just this cloud of stuff, sort of like the asteroid belt, but much bigger and much farther away. But the asteroid belt has another dwarf planet in it called Ceres. Ceres is round, just like Pluto is. It's smaller, but same thing. The rest of the asteroid belt is still there. So that's why Pluto is considered not a planet anymore. It didn't clean up after itself.
Well, two things, a question and then another question. Is it possible for a planet to be like a square? Or not a planet, obviously can't be a planet, but a...
Could an object be square?
Yes.
An object could be square below a certain mass. What happens is gravity pulls in all towards the center of an object in all directions, right? So what if it's pulling everything equally in all directions, anything that is lopsided too much is going to get pulled down. And that's why it gets crushed into a sphere. So if it was a cube like you're talking about, the corners of that cube would get pulled down as the object got bigger. Now, if it's small enough, sure, it could absolutely be a cube.
And then the next question is, Pluto does go through like other orbits, right?
It's part of the time it is closer to the sun than Neptune is. It never actually crosses directly through Neptune's orbit.
Okay.
Because all of the eight major planets orbit in what's called the ecliptic plane, which is a fancy way of saying they are all roughly going over the sun's equator, and they're all kind of horizontally at the same level, for the most part. Pluto is not. Pluto is at an angle. So sometimes it's up above where all the rest of the planets orbit, and sometimes it's down below. It's at an angle of, I think, about 17 degrees. So even though it crosses over Neptune's orbit, it's actually at, either above where Neptune would be or below it. So they're never going to...
crash.
Not unless something else crazy happens. Yeah, they're not going to crash. So Pluto's in a stable orbit. It's a very long orbit. It's a 1 year on Pluto is 248 Earth years.
Oh, wow.
So that's really, really long.
So, yeah.
Yeah. It's, well, what one of the things that produces is Pluto has some of the longest and craziest seasons of any planet. Because think about it, you know, if summer lasts for a fourth of 248 years, that's really long. And because it's at this weird angle, not only is it at a weird angle, but it's also not orbiting in a circle. Most of the planets all orbit in roughly a circle, but Pluto's orbit is also stretched out a little bit. So
oval potato.
Yeah, it is oval. So what happens is, not only are its seasons very long, but its distance from the sun varies a lot, too. And that means for part of its year, it's still freezing cold out there. But for Pluto, it's a lot warmer, and then it gets much, much colder. So that has the effect of really, and I think we're learning now as we've gotten close to it, that really affects its atmosphere, its the surface features. I know you got a chance to look at a few of the pictures that are available online. What did you think of what you saw?
Looked very old.
Well, that's what's interesting about it. For the solar system, it's not very old. Pluto itself is 4.5 billion years old, just like everything else in our solar system is. But if you look at its surface, think of it this way. Let's say you went to a paintball range, and you're getting shot at all the time, like at a steady rate. Like, you know, there's 20 guys, and as you go past the 20 guys, each guy takes a shot, right? So you know you should be getting shot roughly 20 times every time you go by, right? So, in theory, I could count up the number of paintball stains on your fatigues, and I would know how many times you went through the course, right? So, what would I... If you showed up, and I know you had been at that course all day, and you had very few paintball marks on you, that would be puzzling, right? In theory, you should have gotten shot over and over and over again. What that tells me is, well, what do you think that means? How would you explain it? How do you solve that riddle? The person's supposed to get shot all day long, but they look clean.
Nobody was there?
Well, that's one theory, except if we know that Pluto is orbiting in this cosmic shooting gallery, that's why it's not a planet. It hasn't swept its orbit clean, so this stuff is all out there. It should be hitting Pluto all the time, right? So why doesn't it look like it's gotten hit?
Because it hasn't?
No, it's been hit. Think of it another way. If you were covered in paint, what would you do? If you didn't...
I would change my shirt.
Right. You would change your clothes. What's happening is something is happening... Processes are happening on Pluto's surface that are wiping away the signs of the crater. So it's the same thing is happening happened on Earth, right? You don't see too many impact craters on the Earth. And the reason is we've got wind, we've got water, and we've got geology. We've got all of these different processes going that... constantly, and life here on Earth, we wouldn't have that on Pluto, but all of these different processes erode craters, they reshape the surface of the planet, And if you were to look at other objects in the solar system, a good example is our moon, right? Our moon, other than the seas on the moon, those gray empty parts, those are lava plains where lava came out of the moon, covered the surface, and then hardened, and that covered up all the craters that used to be there. But the rest of the surface, it's just nothing but gray and craters, right? And there are moons, there's a moon of Jupiter called Callisto, which is another good example of this. And Callisto is a dark, pretty dark charcoal black kind of ball, again, just covered in craters, right? There's nothing going on geologically, or it has no atmosphere. So once a crater is put there, it stays there. But that's not the case with Pluto. And that's really interesting because Pluto is in a particularly busy part of the solar system. So there must be a lot going on to cover up all of the craters that should be there. So what kind of things do you think might help cover up a crater on a really cold place like Pluto?
Like more stuff getting frozen over?
That's one thing that we're looking at, or we. I say we as if I was involved in this mission. Yeah. That humanity is looking at.
When it gets hot, maybe some stuff melts off.
Great, great point. Right. Like we said, Pluto has this long orbit, so it has a really long summer and a really cold winter. So things on its surface might be, they don't melt because there's no, Pluto's atmosphere is very, very thin. So you need atmospheric pressure to keep gases as a liquid, like to kind of compress them down. Like on Earth, we have our relatively thick atmosphere, so our oceans, our lakes, our rivers, they stay as liquid water on the surface. That's really important for us. If there wasn't an atmosphere, ice would just go straight from being a solid into a gas. Have you ever seen dry ice? It's a carbon dioxide rock, right? So on the Earth's surface,
so cold.
It's really cold, right? It takes a lot of cold to keep that as a rock. But once you take away that cold, it doesn't melt and turn into a pool of carbon dioxide. It just turns right into vapor. That's a process called subliming or sublimation. That's what's happening on Pluto because its atmosphere isn't strong enough to hold stuff down into a liquid form. So we know that, in fact, Pluto's atmosphere stretches out pretty far. It's actually about 1,000 miles up from the surface of the planet. Earth's atmosphere really gets thinned out at about less than 200 miles up. So it's all of this stuff is escaping into space from Pluto all the time. But that also means not all of it is escaping into space. Some of it is getting redistributed as snow on the surface of Pluto. So you can imagine some of the most close-up pictures from the flyby that are available, you can see these snowy, the thing that looks like a heart on Pluto, right? A lot of that is snow. Now, it's not water snow like we're used to on Earth. It's other types of
gases
and substances that, at 300 degrees below zero turn into solids, things like methane. So that heart seems to be a snowy feature. These are snowy-type planes that are covering up maybe craters and old craters and things that are underneath. And as these things get moved around, they kind of scrape the surface and smooth off craters. So that's one of the reasons Pluto's surface looks so young. It's only about 100 million years old. That's pretty young in geologic terms for an object that's 4.6 billion years old. Same with its moon, too. Its moon also, Charon it's called, or Charon, I forget how you pronounce it, but Charon's surface is also fairly smooth, considering how old it is. So something's going on there, too, and it may be similar processes. So that's one of the more interesting discoveries about it, is that we just thought, hey, it could just be this ugly, battered ball of rock that's pretty boring, but it turned out to not be boring at all. Its surface is covered with all kinds of really weird stuff. Did you look at the super close-up?
No.
Okay. That was that one of, like, it looked like kind of a snowfield with these lines all over it. That's one of the closest-up pictures we have from the flyby.
When we, speaking of the flyby... Mm-hmm. You know how any planet moves in its orbit.
Right.
So how did they, like, know exactly where the planet would be when they sent the flyby there?
That is a great question. And the answer is math. We know we can observe the planets. We know, in any object in the solar system, even if it's as small as an asteroid, right, a one-mile-wide boulder, no matter what it is, as long as we know where it is, what direction it's going, and how massive it is, and some of those things we can learn by observing it, we can calculate with incredible precision where it's going to be. We can run models and go like, okay, we know it's going in this direction, and we know, let's say it's going to pass by a planet, we know how much gravity that planet has, so we know that gravity is going to bend the path that object is on, and we know where it's going to go. The equations for it are a little beyond the level of math that you're at right now, but this stuff was all worked out by Isaac Newton and Johannes Kepler and some others hundreds of years ago. They figured out how to do this. And the amazing thing about science is it's predictable, right? So you can, you know, if I throw an object in the air, I can predict where it's going to land if I know exactly how hard if I know how hard I threw it and the direction I threw it in and I account for all these other factors, every single time I will be able to predict with 100% accuracy where that thing is going to go within a very small margin. And to give you an idea of how hard this is, Pluto is billions of miles away. And not only do we have to get to it, we had to get to it by slinging it past Jupiter. We got what's called a gravity assist by having it go past Jupiter. It makes it go a little faster. But again, all of this is predictable. So this would be the equivalent if you had to fly a remote control airplane from Los Angeles to New York, landed on the runway, not just at a runway, but at a particular spot on a particular runway, and the only margin of error you have is the width of a tennis ball. That's how close they had to get it. Now, the spacecraft has navigational software on board that helps it keep track, but the thing about moving through empty space is, if you're not interacting with any other objects, you're going to keep going in a straight line, pretty much. You're not, as long as there's no other gravity or you don't hit anything, what's to stop you, right? This is Isaac Newton's law. An object in motion stays in motion. An object at rest stays at rest unless acted upon by another force. So if you're sitting in that chair and you're not doing anything by yourself, I'm not going to get you out of that chair unless I physically yank you or apply some force to make you do it, right? Similarly, if you're in space and you're trucking along, you're going to keep going until I bump into you or you use some kind of force against you. So that makes it a little easier. As long as you hit the right spots at the right time, you're going to get there. And remember, they're not shooting at where Pluto is. They got to shoot at where it's going to be. So they have to go, all right, we know from observations of Pluto, it will be over there in 9 years. So if we launch it now in that direction, the two of them will meet up at the exact right time. And they did it. They were off by the tiniest margin. I think the flyby happened 72 seconds sooner than they predicted. That's pretty good. That's a hole in one.
What would have happened if it, you know, crashed? They wouldn't.
Well. This is part of the interesting part of the flyby. So the spacecraft, because it's going so fast, it was going 31,000 miles an hour. That's about the fastest thing we've ever launched. So if you're going 31,000 miles an hour while you're trying to take a picture, what's going to happen to the picture?
It's
going to be blurry. And not only that, Pluto is very far away from the sun, so it's a lot dimmer.
Dark.
Yeah, it's dark. So you're taking a picture of a dark object going way faster than a speeding bullet. So what that means is you're not going to have a lot of time to take pictures, and you need to make sure that the pictures you take are taken in such a way that you're going to be able to not have them be a blur, that you can make sense of them later. So the spacecraft turned itself away from the Earth. So it stopped communicating with Earth on purpose, so just so it could maximize the science it could do during this short flyby. So it's like, I don't have time to talk to you, Earth. I got to take as many pictures as I possibly can of everything around me, take all these measurements, and then turn back around and reconnect with Earth and phone home, which it did. Now, if it had crashed or it hadn't done that, we just never would have heard from it again.
We would have wasted $1 billion.
Well, fortunately, it wouldn't have been a total waste because we were still able to get in that scenario, we would still be able to get some pictures of Pluto on approach up until you lost it. But the good news is that because of the navigational software on there, the odds of crashing into Pluto itself were very low. It can see where Pluto is. It can make adjustments, so that didn't happen. The scarier thing was we can't see Pluto very well from Earth. So we were able to figure out that a while back in the 70s that it had a big moon, that one moon we knew about. Then a few years ago, we found a few more moons. So now we know Pluto has 5 moons. The others, other than the big one, are very small. They're like 25 miles wide. Right? They're these space boulders, which is fine. But what if there's one in your way that you can't see from Earth? So a lot of the mission on approach was looking for those things. Like, you know, let's make sure there's nothing in the way just in case. And fortunately, everything went perfectly. It flew by Pluto, it reconnected with home, and it's sending us data and pictures as we speak.
Will it ever come back?
No. No. Not unless... something's made our dog very mad. I can hear in the background. The probe is heading out into the outer reaches of the outer solar system. So, in theory, it's just going to go and go and go and go forever and ever until it encounters, you know, a star or something way down the line. Now, it may go to another Kuiper Belt object that is much smaller than Pluto.
What about a different galaxy? Can it do that?
It can. That's the thing about, like we said about the laws of physics, right? It's going to keep going unless...
Something stops it.
So it's going to go... Now, it may be that the gravity of another object that it encounters affects it, but right now, there's nothing in its path of any size. I mean, Pluto barely had an effect, especially when you're going that fast. You know, it takes a lot to really alter your orbit.
Say it goes into another galaxy and it goes and they're just like, not like there is, but I believe it, there could be like something, some sort of a life on another planet.
Mm-hmm.
Would it take pictures or does it?
No, by the time it got that far, it would be out of power.
It would just, you know, be floating because of gravity.
That's it. It's just, at that point, it's just a projectile. It's just an object that's flying around. It's got a lot of, it's got nuclear batteries that are meant to last a little while. And they conserved a lot of power on it on the way to Pluto because there's nothing to take pictures of for billions of miles. So what they had to do was go into kind of a sleep mode that used very little power while it was coasting. And it's going to probably go back to doing some of that, too. It's still going to do some scientific measurements. There's what they call space weather. There are still conditions in the outer solar system that are interesting to measure, even if there's nothing you can take pictures of that are visible with the human eye. The other thing they're going to do is they're looking. There's got a couple of candidates for objects that they could go visit that are, you know, close enough to the path that it's on that with a little adjustment it could get to some of these things and take pictures. That's going to be a question of funding. They're waiting for the folks at NASA are going to decide whether they have the budget to continue the mission like that. But either way, it's just going to keep on going out into space.
Two things, one and then another.
Mm-hmm.
I might be mistaken, but didn't NASA like shut down or?
Nope. It's fine. They're all still there. Everybody still has a job at NASA.
I don't know why, but I thought I heard that they shut down. Or
no.
They're not going to send anything up.
Oh, it's the space shuttle you're thinking of. The space shuttle program for now is kaput. The reason for that is twofold. One, space shuttle is really expensive. Missions to space are really expensive. And the big reason for that is it takes a lot of energy to get off of Earth. Earth has a lot of gravity. So for, I forget what it is, but there's, you can find out, like for every pound of material you want to send into space, it's like $100,000 or something crazy like that because of the cost of the fuel to do it. So the other side of it is the space shuttles are old. I mean, they were all built in the late 70s or early 80s. We've had two of them explode. We had the Challenger explode in 1986 and then Columbia burned up on reentry.
And then Endeavor's... Oh, done.
Endeavor, they just retired. I mean, look, you know, if you're going up into space, it's really dangerous, right? So how would you feel about going up into space in a rickety old space shuttle from 30 years ago?
How long not... would it take to make a new one? A lot?
Well, they're working on it right now. It's called the Orion program, and they are building and designing new space shuttles, and they're hoping that this generation of spacecraft will not only be able to take us into Earth orbit or back to the moon or even to Mars. Like, that's what they're working on right now. So we're kind of in this between time when the space shuttles are kind of too old to use. And when we need to get into space, we can hitch a ride. On the Russians have some working space vehicles. We'll, you know, we kind of work with them on that. But the new stuff isn't going to be ready, I think, probably till the 2020s. Maybe when those will come out. There's also a lot of private space interest now, so you got companies like SpaceX and Virgin Galactic that are going to try and see if there's any interest in private citizens going to space as opposed to, you know, astronauts, who are all working for the government. But NASA itself did not shut down. NASA is very busy. It's got lots of missions. And in fact, actually, one of the things I wanted to plug was if you live in the Southern California area, JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. That's the part of NASA that is primarily behind all of these probes to other planets. They have an open house every year so you can go and visit it and see, you know, what they're working on, you know, stuff from past missions. It's really cool. They don't do it all the time, but they're doing it again in October. I want to say it's the first weekend in October. I don't have it in front of me, but I'm pretty sure it's in October. So look that up. If you live in California, if you're going to be in California during that time, it's really worth checking out. It's incredible. They have stuff from the entire history of the space program and cool stuff into the future. I went there a couple of years ago when they were working on Curiosity, which is the big Mars rover that's there right now. And I was actually able to watch it being built from, you know, from behind a pane of glass a ways away. But still, you can look down and see they're building a thing that's going to be driving around on the surface of Mars. And that's really cool.
Well, speaking of Mars, that was my follow-up question. Mm-hmm. Is how long would it take us to get to Mars?
To get to Mars? Well, it depends on a couple of different factors. Right? It depends on what system you want to use to get there. You can get to Mars very quickly if you want, you know, the bigger the rocket, the more energy.
What's quick, though, like a year?
I'm trying to think. I mean, look, it takes light 10 minutes or so to get to, 10 to 20 minutes to get to Mars, depending on where it is in its orbit. So when Mars is at the ideal location, meaning the trip is going to be the shortest length, I think people estimate it would probably take several months to get there, at least. Maybe something on the order of, like, 9 months. 8 to 9 months to get there.
As bad as 9 years to get to Pluto or whatever.
It's not nearly, yeah. Getting to the outer solar system is, it would be an extraordinary feat to get. It was crazy we got to the moon, let alone Mars. Mars is very difficult. And one of the most difficult things about Mars is, and any space program, is you're away from the Earth's magnetic field, which means you're not protected from a lot of the scary stuff that the sun burps out all the time. We're protected from that here on the ground, but once you're out in space, that can do some damage to you. And two, you need resources. You need food, water, air. Mars has
none of that. Isn't that new movie that's coming out where the guy...
That's right. It's a Matt Damon movie called The Martian, where he is... It's kind of like Apollo 13, except not a true story, right? He's trapped on the surface of Mars and has to survive somehow. That's the kind of thing you really need to plan for, because you can imagine... being stranded there, that's it. You're going to die. You know, that's pretty scary. The outer solar system is even harder. It's farther away.
It's gas.
Well, you're not going to land... Yeah, you're not going to land on any of the outer planets because they're all gas giants. You'd have to work on their moons.
Are they non-solid? Like, there's nothing hard in there?
There is. It's kind of hard to explain. There's not like a... First, you'd have this gaseous layer. Then you would have a liquid layer, but there wouldn't be like a dividing line like there is on Earth. Like there's the ocean and then there's the atmosphere. It would actually blur. It would get like, it would be like foggier and denser, and then slowly you would be in this liquid phase. And below that, you would eventually come to a solid core at the very bottom. So there is something solid down there, but it wouldn't be anything like you can imagine, you know, taking a submarine down there or anything like that. Plus the pressures would be...
Unbelievable.
Yeah, you wouldn't be there. I don't think we could build something that could survive it.
Not even if the metal's yay thick.
No, not even if the metal is yay thick and it's Wolverine's adamantium skeleton. There is no way we can build anything that we can conceive of that can survive in that environment, let alone allow humans to survive in it, as opposed to, say, a robot probe. The other problem with getting to the outer solar system where Pluto is usually you have, like we talked about, New Horizons used Jupiter for a boost. That's probably what we would have to do if we wanted to get to Saturn or beyond. The problem is Jupiter itself pumps out a lot of radiation, enough to kill you. So the problem is you need to get close to it to get farther out in the solar system, but you wouldn't survive the flyby. Under our current technology, we would need to develop some kind of technology that would shield us from that radiation and make it survivable. But again, you're way far away from Earth, you're far away from the sun. So you're missing light, you need water and food, and there's none of it to be found out there. It's really hard to imagine colonizing any of these places on our current technology. So anything else you want to talk about with Pluto itself? I think we talked about Pluto a little bit. We talked about Charon. Here's an interesting fact about Pluto and Charon. They're actually a double planet. We call that, or it's considered, because they're Pluto, and or I should say Charon, is very big relative to the size of Pluto. For example, for if the Earth was to have that same relationship to our moon would have to be 7 times bigger than it is practically. It would be much, much larger. Charon doesn't quite orbit Pluto, and Pluto doesn't quite orbit Charon. They're orbiting each other. So you can picture, they're tumbling around each other, around a point in space in between the two of them, because their masses are so evenly matched, or comparatively evenly.
So instead of, I know they can know what I'm doing, but I'm showing you, like, the Earth is like that.
Yeah.
The moon's like that, and it's like,
you know. You could picture, like, you know, the Earth, you hold up your fist and keep it still, and you could take your finger and move it around your fist like that without moving it. That's sort of what the Earth is like to the moon. But now the reality is every object in the solar system relative to something that's orbiting it does the same thing, right? The Earth does wobble around as the moon goes around it, but the point that they're wobbling around is inside the body of the Earth, right? Well, the wobble isn't that pronounced. But you can imagine the bigger the two, if the two objects are pretty evenly matched, one isn't going to dominate the other so much. So you'll get what you have here, where they're kind of tumbling. And the other weird thing about it is Pluto is on its side relative to the other planets, except for Uranus. Uranus is also on its side. And we know that Uranus is on its side because we believe because it was hit by something that knocked it over. So it's not clear if Pluto has the same deal, because Pluto's surface has been refurbished by itself. So there's no record of an impact, certainly nothing big enough to have knocked it like that, unless Charon is that record, right? The Earth's moon was blasted off of the Earth by an impact, and the material that was ejected coalesced into the object that is now our moon. Pluto and Charon may have had the same deal. There's just no record of it on the surface.
Speaking of Uranus, is it really Uranus or is it Uranus?
It's Uranus. Get over it, everybody. It's not Uranus. But yeah, as far as I know, it's pronounced Uranus. But you know what? You really should. It's a figure from Greek mythology. So if you know a Greek person, ask them how it should be pronounced, because they'll give you the straight story.
You know, that's the one thing in school you can get away with saying in front of a teacher.
Uranus?
Uranus.
Yeah, you'll find others, I'm sure, as you go through your scientific career. I can't think of any off the top of my head, but there are definitely some naughty, naughty names for things. Speaking of names for things, you know what they're going to name all the, like, mountains and, like, valleys and things that they found on Pluto? They had a contest where they had a website and people could submit, you know, vote on names for things they liked. And a large number of them are going to be from works of fiction that have to deal with, like, dark and spooky places. Because Pluto is named for the Lord of the Underworld. So they're going with, like, Mordor. I know that there's a dark spot on the top of Charon's North Pole. That's going to be called Mordor, I think. Then there's other places that are going to be called things like Cthulhu, which is from H.P. Lovecraft horror stories. And I think they're going to use stuff from The Neverending Story. They're going to use things from Chronicles of Narnia. Like, all these, like, scary, spooky things that you can think of, they're going to use to name stuff on Pluto. So that's going to be kind of cool. Except for the Big Heart. The Big Heart on Pluto is going to be named Tumba Regio. Regio is just a fancy way of saying region. It's Latin. Tumba is named for Clyde Tumba, the American astronomer who discovered Pluto in the first place. So he gets this nice honor that he's going to be, his name is going to go on the friendliest feature about Pluto.
Until it possibly goes away.
Until it possibly goes away. That's the interesting part, is if we went back to Pluto in, say, 100 years when it's at a different part of its orbit, or even, you know, in another 248 years, let's say it's at the same spot it is now, we go and visit it again, that heart may not be there.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting. Depending on how thick that snow or cap is, it could be completely gone. We don't know. So that's pretty interesting, too, to think that it really is changing all the time. Tumba also got to visit Pluto in his own way. They put he was cremated after he died, and they put some of his ashes onto the probe in a little container. So he got to fly by Pluto, which is pretty cool.
Good for him.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind taking it. Well, so, I wouldn't want to die to go to another planet, but still, it's a nice thing. They also shot Gene Roddenberry, who created Star Trek. They shot his ashes into space, too. So, if you make a name for yourself in the space industry, you might get to go into orbit after you die, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, you had a question.
I think we, not male yet, but do we have a...
No, we don't. There's not really any myths about Pluto. The myths were that we normally do a segment on the show where we cover some sort of scientific myth and debunk it, but we didn't know enough about Pluto to have a myth. You know, there's just, until last week, it was just a point of light in the distance. We were able to make a very rudimentary map by watching Charon go in front of Pluto and then back. You were able to watch the way the light dipped, and depending on how dark it got as Charon went by, that told you a little bit about the surface features. And we posted on our Facebook page, someone took that really rudimentary map and compared it to the real thing we got in photographs, and you can see, like, oh, yeah, we were able to detect, like, that splotch that now we know is heart-shaped. We could see there was a bright region over there, but, you know, nothing you could use to navigate your way around. But, so, yeah, that's how little we knew about Pluto. We basically knew where it was. We knew it had one moon and eventually five, and we knew a little bit about its mass and its orbit. But even then, like, we found out that Pluto is, like, 50 miles wider than we thought it was from Earth. And that's just because you just can't take very good observations of something that small and that far away and be accurate with our technology. You have to get up and close and taste it and see it and measure it. Not just invisible light, because we're measuring it. Yeah. You can, I mean, there's certain things that we can see with our eyeballs, but then it's like, hey, let's look at this thing in ultraviolet light. Let's look at it in infrared light. What can we see? And sometimes you can see different features in those different lighting scenarios that tell you more about what's going on the surface. And there's going to be a whole lot more that we discover, right? We're, the spacecraft is slowly beaming pictures back to us, so...
Only, like, 30,000 miles an hour.
Well, it's going 30,000 miles an hour. The signal it's sending at the speed is sending at the speed of light, and it's so far away that to get a signal to the probe or to get one back from the probe takes 4.5 hours. That's pretty far. But so not only is it a long way away, but the signal it's sending is fairly weak. It's the equivalent of, 56K modem, which was how... Kids, this is how we used to connect to the internet. We had modems back in my day, which was a phone line that would call and you would go, which I'm sure has no purpose at all. I would love to meet the guy who invented that and decided we needed to sound like a cat being put in a wood chipper before you connect to the internet. But anyway, it's a very slow internet connection. It's like having less than one bar, right, on your modern smartphone. So it's going to take a long, long time to get all this data. They think it's probably going to take about 18 months to get everything back. So once a week, they're going to go on the, if you go to the Pluto's missions website, they're going to release a packet of information, I think on Fridays, like every Friday. Here's a bunch of new pictures. Here's a bunch of new measurements that we were able to get by sampling, you know, measuring Pluto's atmosphere or the way the solar wind interacts with it, things like that. So even though we're talking about Pluto today here on our podcast in July, we may know a whole lot more in August, September, and as the year goes on, there's going to be lots of interesting surprises. We may find geysers on Pluto. People were hoping to see that. We haven't seen it yet, but
we might find beasts, like dragons, like flying around yeah, burning people up.
That's less likely, but sure. Pluto is...
Bunnies, anything.
Yeah.
I'd like to see a bunny on Pluto. I'd like to see a dog on Pluto.
That would be the winner, right? We have found organic molecules on Pluto's surface, but organic molecules doesn't mean life. That's not the same thing. Organic is, to a scientist, means it's got carbon in it. That's all that really means. But these are complex carbon molecules. But what's really cool about it is these things are forming everywhere. We found them all over the place in the solar system, and these are not life, but these are important building blocks for life. So it doesn't mean we're going to find life on Pluto, but what it means is if we're talking about is there life elsewhere, anywhere in the cosmos, the more common these types of substances are, it increases the likelihood that on some planet somewhere, these things have come together to make some kind of life like they have here on Earth.
What is the, I don't know, it's a random question, but like how much like galaxies is there?
Oh my
theoretically.
God.
Billions?
Hundreds of billions.
So, like, my thing is like, obviously it's going to be tough to get that energy to get something there, mm-hmm. but how is there, we are the only one thing in hundreds of billions of, like, I don't think that's, like,
likely?
Possible.
Yeah, that's a really great argument in favor of extraterrestrial life, is just that, man, there's just so much space. There's so many, it's like every planet that exists within what we call the habitable zone, meaning it's not so far away as to be a frozen wasteland like Pluto is, and not too hot, and it has an atmosphere. Every time you find a planet like that, it's like you're rolling the dice again and again. And
isn't that one that we found kind of?
We found, yeah, there's a planet called around a star called Gliese, which is not too far away. And they think that, I mean, it's the closest match they've found for anything like Earth. It's not a guarantee there's life or anything like it, but it's Earth-sized, it's in the habitable zone. We think we've detected things, I'd have to check on this, but I thought we might have detected water vapor on the
planet. And also, like, maybe Mars, they found, like, germs or something?
Well, not yet. No, they found, in the 90s, they found a rock that looked like it might have had fossils of bacteria in it. And they knew the rock was from Mars by measuring the gases and stuff. It had bits of Mars's atmosphere trapped inside. But you looked at these things under a microscope and they go, gee, they kind of look like the fossils of remains of bacteria. But ultimately, those tests have proven inconclusive. It's not saying it isn't, but it's not saying it is either. So
can't prove it.
Can't prove it one way or the other, so we got to do more science to find out. It's that's the great part about science. You can always ask more questions. And
we could teleport rocks.
Well, teleport, we're not there yet either. That's a long way away. So far, we've only been able to teleport very tiny subatomic particles with no mass. But it's a start. But as far as life on other planets and other galaxies goes, yeah. I mean, the number of them. And we talked about this a little. We did an episode on aliens, and we talked about something called the Drake equation, if you remember that. And that was a theoretical equation. So it's like you take the number of, you know, one, how many stars are there? How many stars have planets? How many of those planets are in a habitable region? How many of those planets actually develop life? How much of that life evolves to a point where it's intelligent? How much of that life that's intelligent evolves to a point where it could communicate with us? And how much of that life has evolved to a point where it's intelligent, it can communicate with us, and it hasn't, you know, wiped itself out through nuclear war or something? And the problem is we don't know any of those variables except for kind of the number of stars. So we're working in the dark here. But what I think what the great thing about a mission to Pluto shows is, you know, everybody, a lot of people probably thought, why are we wasting our time? It's going to be a frozen, you know,
wasteland.
It's going to be nothing. It's going to be a ball. It's going to be gray. Yeah, teenage wasteland. It's going to be covered in craters, and that's it. It's going to look like the moon, but colder. Like, that's boring. But as always, every time we do one of these things, it surprises you. This is the third new planetary flyby in my lifetime. I was born in 1980, and in 1986, we got our first close-up look at Uranus, and in 1989, we got Neptune, and finally, in 2015, we got Pluto. But there's still plenty more in the solar system to explore. There's places we've already been to. There's places that we need to see more of close-up. They're working on maybe sending a submarine to Saturn's moon Titan.
With people in it, or no?
No, not with people in it. A robot. Because Titan has actual lakes on its surface, so we want to check those out. We want to go into the oceans of Europa and see if there's life down there.
If the submarine's yellow, maybe Ringo Starr will volunteer.
He's getting old. He could make it a one-way trip, I suppose, if he really wanted to do something groovy. Anything else you want to know about Pluto or you want to talk about before we do some mail?
I think we're pretty much good. I think we should put on some mail.
She wrote about it. Return to sender. Address unknown.
I don't want to read all this mail.
All right. Well, we've got two letters. I wrote them down, and I hope I remember them correctly. I don't have my notes in front of me. But the first one is from Maddox from Scotland. And he or she, I suppose, wanted to know why we did a flyby of Pluto instead of landing on it or stopping and orbiting it. What do you think the reason for that is?
We can't, or we couldn't. It's not like...
Well, we can. I mean, we certainly have the engineering capability to do it.
It
wouldn't freeze. I mean, it's already out there in the cold. It wouldn't be any colder on the surface of Pluto than it would in deep space. But here's it's a trade-off. We could do it, but there's a couple of problems. It takes a long, long, long time to get to Pluto. So that means to do it in any sort of reasonable speed, you got to go really fast. Right? If you're going really fast...
Energy.
Yeah, if you want to slow, then you're going to have to slow down to land on Pluto or go into orbit. And that takes a lot of fuel to do that. And the fuel has mass, which means the probe weighs more. It takes more fuel to get it there now because it's heavier. So it's doable, but it just means it would be a lot harder. And the bottom line is it would have taken a lot longer to do it. So instead of having this discussion now, we'd be having it in 5 years from now. And Pluto would be getting farther and farther away all the time. So the decision was made to just do it as a flyby instead of and a lander would be extra complicated. And the bummer about a lander is, of course, it's mostly stuck in one place. But maybe someday, who knows? If this mission taught us anything, Pluto was a really interesting place. So people might be more interested in going back to it. It's just, it is tough because it is so, so far away. So
yes.
That's a great question. And then the other question we got was from Tyler H., And Tyler wanted to know, what's the heart made of? We are learning that as we go.
Muscles.
Yes, the heart is made of muscles. It's got four ventricles. Pluto's heart is, as we talked about, it's a kind of methane snow. It's methane, nitrogen, a lot of gases that actually we find in the Earth's atmosphere, too. But not just because we're special, but because those are very common things to find in the solar system. They're made out of pretty low-numbered atoms. So nitrogen, methane's got carbon, it's got hydrogen. It's stuff that you see a lot of out in the solar system. So it's the same. It's out there on Pluto, too. But because the conditions are different, it behaves differently. So I hope that answers your question. Yeah, it's a heart made of ice. So I'm sure someone will write a song about it. But
if you've seen Frozen, the heart freezes.
Yeah, so Pluto's got a frozen heart, and who knows? Maybe now that they're naming stuff on there, they'll name something after Anna and Elsa and everybody else. So I hope that answers your questions, guys. And I think that does it for this episode of Quarks in Recreation. Obviously, there's going to be a lot more to learn about Pluto. So keep checking in on our Facebook page and also on the Pluto's mission website, since frankly that's going to where we're going to learn all of this from. They're the ones who've got the information. They're the ones doing the press releases. So check them out. I believe it's pluto.jpl.something. So search for Pluto and JPL and you'll find it. In the meantime, our website is www.quarksandrec.com. You can go to facebook.com/quarksandrec or tweet us at Quarks and Rec. And Brandon, tell them what we're doing for our next episode.
Our next episode, we are going to do, like, the cartoons.
Yeah, we're going to do the science of animation. So that'll be pretty neat if you got questions about how cartoons are made. Both, we're going to cover everything from old hand-drawn animation, 2D stuff, to 3D animation, to video games. Anything where you see some kind of animation, we're going to talk about how that stuff is made. So I think that'll be pretty exciting. So until then, I'm Doug.
I'm Brandon.
And we'll see you later. Bye.
I represent the smallest planet. Attorney in the Cerny versus those who tried to ban it. If you don't agree, go see Interplanet Janet, cause the sun is star, like Pluto is planet. So lend me all your years and let me state my case about all the types of satellites we must embrace. Cause like my parents, great-grandparents, this planet was an immigrant.
To the planets and a family.
It's an upstanding member of the solar system. Apply the laws of Earth and make it a victim. A proposition, 187. When Pluto spawns a moon, it will apply to the heavens. I'll damn thee like Judas of Iscariot. If you demote this boat remote to a billion, it's like taking E.T. Cessity from Elliot. Support your Lily put, cause
simply put,